Here we stand. It's Sunday, September 29th. I am your regular host, Kevin Annett, Eagle Strong Voice. That was Phil Oakes, our brother Phil Oakes, a great 60s folk singer. Died tragically in 1975, but his message lives on, as did the Wandering Carpenter. That spirit embodies all of us, folks, when we're talking about the common law. Our purpose, regardless of where we live, is to reclaim the world for all of humanity. That's our theme on the Here We Stand show. This is the official voice of the Republic of Canada and the Common Law Republic movement. If you listen later in the show, I'm going to give a personal reflection, as people have sometimes asked me, like, what exactly do you think about Jesus? Are you still a Christian? Etc., Kev. I'll give you a little insight into my own view about all that, because it's part of the whole bigger movement we're involved in. Majority of Canadians want a republic. They want an end to the corporatocracy, the British Crown, its ties with the Vatican criminals. And people all over the world want the same thing. And we are struggling to not only teach people about that and activate them, but organize an alternative. That's what we're doing right now as we speak across Canada. We broadcast live every Sunday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time from the heart of our new nation on the territory of the genocidal regime known as the Dominion of Canada. You can follow our updates online at murderbydecree.com under ITCCS updates and write to us at republicofcanada@gmail.com. And today, a very special hello goes out from me to our Steel Magnolia. You know who you are. Well, today on our program, news and updates from the campaign to elect delegates to the First Congress of the Republic of Canada. Why Canadians should not commit treason by voting in the upcoming parliamentary elections. Why the Crime Minister, the Prime Minister, little mini-me Trudeau, is avoiding public debates and is dodging a legal summons to appear before a Vancouver War Crimes Tribunal. All of that and more coming up. First of all, I thought it would be nice to start with a joke. Here it is. I heard today that Prime Minister Justin Trudeau just had a sex change. He became a man. Well, actually, no, he didn't. The cowardly bozo doesn't have the balls to even show up at party leaders' televised election debates. He's crept out of two of them already. I suppose Justin's worried about being asked why he's allowed the Chinese military to station their forces on Canadian soil, and why he's recently had secret meetings with the very Chinese generals who are engaged in the lucrative organ trafficking trade that spans the Pacific. Did somebody say missing and murdered Aboriginal women? Small wonder that the trained government seals called the Canadian media have been dutifully running cute puff pieces on Justin, painting his face brown, to distract from the growing evidence of his personal complicity in treason and human trafficking. That complicity and much more is being documented as we speak by a citizens' war crimes tribunal in the city of Vancouver. That tribunal plans to release some of its evidence by mid-October, after touring more than a dozen small communities across British Columbia and speaking firsthand eyewitnesses. These witnesses have described how Chinese paramilitaries and RCMP officers are wiping out Aboriginal families who stand in the way of not only the lucrative liquid natural gas operations being headed by PetroChina, the biggest oil and gas company in Asia, but they stand in the way of illegal Chinese immigrants that are being smuggled into BC through the superport of Prince Rupert and are driving out native people from their land. Apparently, Justin Trudeau is privy to and profiting personally from this whole murderous operation. More on that in October. Stand by. The fun and games, of course, aren't confined to our own Manchurian candidate prime minister. Believe it or not, this past week, guess what? The entire Supreme Court of Canada went on a slick public relations road tour, first time in their history. And they're out there promoting how wonderful and democratic the Canadian legal system is supposed to be. That's right, all nine Supreme Court justices have been going into malls and schools across, well, at least Ontario, and pressing the flesh of all of us ordinary Canucks with all the finesse of ballot whores hungry for public office. The Chief Justice, Big Dick Wagner, actually said, "You are the law," to a pack of grade 8 honor roll students in Etobicoke. Well, why all this pretense and hype now by the guys in robes? Could it have anything to do with the criminal culpability of Dick's official boss, old tottering Lizzie Britt in London, and by association, Dick himself? Or maybe all of our Republican talk of abolishing crown courts and creating common law ones directed by we the people is forcing the nine justices to wipe the cobwebs off their robes and appear at least to get down with the people for a few days. Your guess is as good as mine. But it does go to show you, folks, that as proponents of a republic, our ideas have a power that far exceeds our numbers. As the American Revolutionary Thomas Paine said, an army of principles can penetrate where an army of soldiers cannot. So take it to heart, friends, and keep spreading the good news of a grassroots republic run by and for the people. Ideas are infectious, and once they're rooted in a people's mind, they can't ever be wiped out. But we've got to do more than talk. Better than mere talk, you have to help us make that republic a reality. Help convene a people's assembly in your own neighborhood. We're doing it already across the country. You can learn how to do so through the convener nearest to you and our bulletins. Write to us, republicofcanada@gmail.com. Well, on the Republican campaign front, congressional delegates Brenda Everall, Timothy Barch, and yours truly, Kevin Annett, have been working with new citizens in local communities across Ontario, Manitoba, and BC to set up working Republican assemblies that can pass and enforce their own laws. In the last week, we've been joined by two new delegates, Peter Deakins in Port Alberni, British Columbia, and Jeremiah Jourdain in Portage-la-Prairie, Manitoba. Over 100 new people have recently pulled out of Canada and sworn citizenship in the Republic of Canada. As a result, they now stand under the protective jurisdiction of that republic. That means they have common law sheriffs and courts to protect them. Also, by showing their citizenship cards, they're entitled to free access to public transit and medical services anywhere in Canada, under the common law right of reparations. Reparations? What are those, I hear you say? Well, it's very simple. Each of us has been systematically robbed and defrauded by the British Crown for our entire lives, as were our ancestors. And under common law, we're owed all of that stolen wealth back. So we're not going to talk about it. We're going to go ahead and reclaim it for all of the people who are citizens in the new republic. We're doing that by withholding taxes in our own communities, seizing buildings and land, nullifying debts, kind of like what Jesus did wherever he went. Same revolution, folks. You'll hear more on that a little bit later in the show. So, reclaiming, that's what it's all about. New citizens can also vote in the local Republican Assembly. You can formulate laws, and you can serve as Republican sheriffs and conveners. Now, you should read our book about that. You can get it online. The Case for Canada. Go to Amazon.com. Just put in my name, Kevin Annett, A-N-N-E-T-T, and look for The Case for Canada. It's got our lovely flag there with the three stars and the two-hour wampum flag. Finally, on a personal note, before we get to these clips, everywhere I've gone across Canada, I've encountered amazing support for what we're doing for a grassroots republic. We've been doing a straw poll on the ground among people, and we found the support for a republic is running at nearly 70%, 7-0, folks. That's up from 58% 5 years ago in the decimal poll made across the country on the same issue. People are just sick and tired of the old regime. But there's no point in talking about the republic unless many more of you are willing to move from passive support to active involvement. You have to take personal responsibility for this cause. Now, I know that's difficult for a lot of you because you've never been taught to do that. You've never been encouraged or shown how to be responsible for yourself or for the society around you. But for the few of you who are now willing to assume such responsibility, it begins really simply. You pledge citizenship to the republic, and you form or join a local people's assembly. You are the ones who are going to be the local leadership. You're going to make it happen every day of your life from now on, not just when you feel like it. We're not doing this as a nice intention, but because our lives depend on it. And you know what I'm talking about. Once you know from your own experience that your life is on the line over this and the lives of our children, you'll find the commitment to be a consistent fighter for liberty and not just an occasional dabbler in a nice idea. But look, it goes a lot deeper than that. Mohandas Gandhi once said that political independence from the British Crown was pointless if the people of India didn't first win their spiritual independence from that empire. Otherwise, they'd just end up replicating the empire under a new boss. And sure enough, that's what happened. We can't repeat that mistake in Canada. We have to first free ourselves from our own mental and spiritual subservience and complicity with the genocidal regime and everything it's done to us, native or non-native. We have to not only pull our taxes and votes out of the system, but our hearts, our minds, and our souls as well. We must, in practice, unlearn the mindset and culture of the mass murder, the lies, and the group crime upon which Canada was founded and has been sustained. We have to rise to a higher virtue in ourselves, and through leading by personal example, trigger and mobilize the selfless goodwill that lies latent everywhere among everyone I meet. They're just looking for a way to express it. You have to be that grassroots leadership in your own community. So don't wait for somebody else to do it for you. I get too much of that from people. They keep saying, Kev, what do we do next? You know what you need to do. Your conscience tells you what you need to do. You have to find the courage and the determination to fight and create that now. Start now. Reclaim the taxes, the lands, the wealth of your community. Show by example what it means to be self-governing citizens of a true republic of equals. People who can reclaim and make our nation and our world. Now, our organizing bulletins, this radio program every week, and our book, The Case for Canada, will show you how to do so, as well as your own invaluable experiences. The important thing is to start now. Well, in that spirit and in a lighter vein, I want to share with you a couple of clips that follow. The first is commentary by our wonderful political comedian friend, George Carlin, who talks about the need to reclaim our language, to get rid of the soft language that hides rather than reveals the truth. We have to reclaim our own language and dispense with the false euphemisms used to enslave us. Following, I do a reflection on something I call Crazy Walter Meets the Anglican Primate, and what do I think of Jesus anyway? After all, the worst crime is always the one committed against the innocent by people with God on their lips. And the mainstream churches of Canada will continue to get away with the rape, trafficking, and killing of children unless you and I stop them. Anyway, on to the clips. Enjoy and learn and act. I will be back for brief sign-off after the clips. Thank you.
Now I probably got some other group pissed off at me because I said fruit. There's a different group to get pissed off at you in this country for everything you're not supposed to say. Can't say fruit, can't say faggot, can't say queer, can't say Nancy boy, can't say pansy. Can't say nigger, boogie, jig, jigaboo, skinhead, jungle bunny, mooly, moulinyan, or schwatzer. Can't say yid, heeb, zeeb, kike, maki, dago, guinea, wop, ginzo, greaser, greaseball, spick, beaner, oye, tiger, PR, mick, donkey, turkey, limey, frog, squarehead, kraut, jerry, hun, chink, jap, nip, slope, slopehead, zip, zipperhead, gook. There is absolutely nothing wrong. There is absolutely nothing wrong with any of those words in and of themselves. They're only words. It's the context that counts. It's the user. It's the intention behind the words that makes them good or bad. The words are completely neutral. The words are innocent. I get tired of people talking about bad words and bad language. Bullshit. It's the context that makes them good or bad. The context that makes them good or bad. For instance, you take the word nigger. There is absolutely nothing wrong with the word nigger in and of itself. It's the racist asshole who's using it that you ought to be concerned about. We don't care when Richard Pryor or Eddie Murphy say it. Why? Because we know they're not racist. They're niggers. Context. Context. We don't mind their context because we know they're black. Hey, I know I'm Whitey, the blue-eyed devil, patio fade, gray boy, honky motherfucker myself. Don't bother my ass. They're only words. You can't be afraid of words that speak the truth, even if it's an unpleasant truth, like the fact that there's a bigot and a racist in every living room on every street corner in this country. I don't like words that hide the truth. I don't like words that conceal reality. I don't like euphemisms or euphemistic language. And American English is loaded with euphemisms because Americans have a lot of trouble dealing with reality. Americans have trouble facing the truth. So they invent the kind of a soft language to protect themselves from it. And it gets worse with every generation. For some reason, it just keeps getting worse. I'll give you an example of that. There's a condition in combat. Most people know about it. It's when a fighting person's nervous system has been stressed to its absolute peak and maximum, can't take any more input. The nervous system has either snapped or is about to snap. In the First World War, that condition was called shell shock. Simple, honest, direct language. Two syllables, shell shock. Almost sounds like the guns themselves. That was 70 years ago. Then a whole generation went by, and the Second World War came along, and the very same combat condition was called battle fatigue. Four syllables now. Takes a little longer to say. Doesn't seem to hurt as much. Fatigue is a nicer word than shock. Shell shock. Battle fatigue. Then we had the war in Korea, 1950. Madison Avenue was riding high by that time. And the very same combat condition was called operational exhaustion. Hey, we're up to eight syllables now. And the humanity has been squeezed completely out of the phrase. It's totally sterile now. Operational exhaustion. Sounds like something that might happen to your car. Then, of course, came the war in Vietnam, which has only been over for about 16 or 17 years. And thanks to the lies and deceit surrounding that war, I guess it's no surprise that the very same condition was called post-traumatic stress disorder. Still eight syllables, but we've added a hyphen. And the pain is completely buried under jargon. Post-traumatic stress disorder. I'll bet you, if we'd have still been calling it shell shock, some of those Vietnam veterans might have gotten the attention they needed at the time. I'll bet you that. I'll bet you that. But it didn't happen. And one of the reasons is because we were using that soft language, that language that takes the life out of life. And it is a function of time. It does keep getting worse. I'll give you another example. Sometime during my life, toilet paper became bathroom tissue. I wasn't notified of this. No one asked me if I agreed with it. It just happened. Toilet paper became bathroom tissue. Sneakers became running shoes. False teeth became dental appliances. Medicine became medication. Information became directory assistance. The dump became the landfill. Car crashes became automobile accidents. Partly cloudy became partly sunny. Motels became motor lodges. House trailers became mobile homes. Used cars became previously owned transportation. Room service became guest room dining. And constipation became occasional irregularity. When I was a little kid, if I got sick, they wanted me to go to the hospital and see the doctor. Now they want me to go to a health maintenance organization or a wellness center to consult a healthcare delivery professional. Poor people used to live in slums. Now the economically disadvantaged occupy substandard housing in the inner cities. And they're broke. They're broke. They don't have a negative cash flow position. They're fucking broke. Because a lot of them were fired. You know, fired. Management wanted to curtail redundancies in the human resources area. So many people are no longer viable members of the workforce. Smug. Greedy, well-fed white people have invented a language to conceal their sins. It's as simple as that. The CIA doesn't kill anybody anymore. They neutralize people. Or they depopulate the area. The government doesn't lie and engages in disinformation. The Pentagon actually measures nuclear radiation in something they call sunshine units. Israeli murderers are called commandos. Arab commandos are called terrorists. Contra killers are called freedom fighters. Well, if crime fighters fight crime and firefighters fight fire, what do freedom fighters fight? They never mention that part of it to us, do they? Never mention that part of it. And some of this stuff is just silly. We all know that. Like on the airlines, they say they want a pre-board. Well, what the hell is pre-board? What does that mean? To get on before you get on? They say they're going to pre-board those passengers in need of special assistance. Cripples! Simple, honest, direct language. There's no shame attached to the word cripple that I can find in any dictionary. No shame attached to it. In fact, it's a word used in Bible translations. Jesus healed the cripples. Doesn't take seven words to describe that condition. But we don't have any cripples in this country anymore. We have the physically challenged. Is that a grotesque enough evasion for you? How about differently abled? I've heard them called that, differently abled. You can't even call these people handicapped anymore. They'll say, we're not handicapped, we're handicapable. These poor people have been bullshitted by the system into believing that if you change the name of the condition, somehow you'll change the condition. Doesn't happen. Doesn't happen. We have no more deaf people in this country, hearing impaired. No one's blind anymore, partially sighted or visually impaired. We have no more stupid people. Everybody has a learning disorder. Or he's minimally exceptional. How would you like to be told that about your child? He's minimally exceptional. Oh, thank God for that. Psychologists actually have started calling ugly people those with severe appearance deficits. It's getting so bad that any day now I expect to hear a rape victim referred to as an unwilling sperm recipient.
Hi, everyone. It's Kevin Annett. Well, as you may or may not know, you know now, I published my 16th book called The Border, a post-Canadian anthology, written as more biographical reflection and also a selection of my sermons, lectures, various public talks over the years, written hopefully from a more humorous, because what can you do but view tragedy with its flip side, humor? I'm going to start with something I call parting shots. Why do primates kill their own kind? A Christmas epistle to Anglican primate Fred Hiltz, written in the year 2015. This is quite appropriate since Mr. Hiltz, who helped cover up the genocide at the Anglican Mohawk School in Brantford, Ontario, this was a letter written to him personally in the course of all of that. Dear primate Fred, you probably have never heard of Crazy Walter, even though he collapsed the pomp and dignity of one of your predecessors on a memorable spring day in 1990 at the Vancouver Seminary I attended. Walter was someone as unacceptable as Jesus in action. He dropped out of the Vancouver School of Theology, or VST, to enter a higher calling and career of random street corner preaching in Toronto, engaging in the kind of ecstatic joy so unfamiliar to the Church of England. As for a primate, what's his name, who Walt accosted, the sorry bastard's long since retired to wherever it is that simians end up. But the memory of their brief encounter is forever pristine. Walt was a bearded wild man who hung around our seminary and sometimes even attended classes, although the profs all hated him because he knew so much. But everyone tolerated him with such apparent liberality because they were all too scared to ask him to leave. I liked the guy because of how he made all of the pious bunnies run for cover. So, on the memorable morning in question, Walt was trying to liven up the place, as was his wont, since the sight of all of us oh-so-serious aspiring clerics tended to piss the guy off royally. His intense blue eyes jabbed at us unmercifully as he expounded the truth of what the Bible really meant, usually waving his arms and employing suggestive hip thrusts and touches of ribaldry that made the more devout students blush and look away. "I'm here to skewer you ungrateful little bastards with the word," he had exclaimed that morning, to the scowls of those of my church colleagues who had never met a real live prophet before. Walt was on a roll that day, and my buddy Rich Lang and I were close to nervous exhaustion for having laughed our guts out. Then, suddenly, an announcement was made that sounded like the heralding of the Second Coming. A fervent young woman student exclaimed, "The Anglican primate is here!" The room went quiet for a moment. And then, like a pilgrim on the verge of a sacred orgasm, Walter's eyes sparkled and he shouted out gleefully, "The fucking primate?" Without another word, Crazy Walter leapt up and hurried to the doorway and deliberately thrust his ass in the direction of the potentate, who had just entered the main hallway of VST. Walt then began to slowly rotate his considerable buns in the direction of his fellow primate and emit the kind of sounds that undoubtedly make it happen for your average baboon in rut. "It's the primate!" Walt shouted and sang gleefully. "The fucking primate!" Rich and I collapsed on the floor, screeching and gasping for air. Through tears of laughter, I caught Walter jumping up and down in the hallway, his ass still offered to the churchman, as the Anglican primate's shocked entourage stood bewildered and gaping. The church groupies were too stupid to even be embarrassed. Well, being Canadians, none of them said anything, of course. His primateness gave Walter a rather strange look. And then, without a word, as if his mocker was not even there, Monkey Man and his church mob shuffled off for a sumptuous feast and booze fest somewhere in the building. By the time Crazy Walter returned to us in triumph, the majority of our career-conscious fellow students had scattered in terror. Walt beamed with avuncular pride at Rich and me for staying, throwing his weary and sizable buns down on the couch, and he announced, "Sorry, guys, it was all that purple the fucker wore. Made me randy as hell." I realize now that Walter was sane and knew more than he was actually letting on. Now, Fred, Mr. Hiltz, I know that the topic of anal intercourse must make you nervous, being a head churchman and all, but bear with me for a minute. Let me try to lubricate the topic, with a theological reference to make the impact a little bit gentler. Let's start with someone that you Anglicans tend to avoid as much as they do guys like Walter. And that's Jesus himself. Someone who, as you know, got strung up for pissing off top churchmen like you, Fred. After all, Jesus' prescription for child rapists was to tie a 10-ton grinding stone around their neck and throw them into the nearest ocean, presumably with lots of loving and forgiving nonviolence. So we know where that leaves you guys and those whom you protect. Shit out of luck, as Walt would have said. What is the Anglican Church's punishment for raping a child, Fred? Forget it, I already know the answer. It's nothing. Like your colleagues, the Papists, you call the destruction of a child a forgivable sin. Canadian law requires only a wrist-slapping 1-year mandatory sentence in jail for child rape. So it's not as if you're under any pressure to go hard on the sickos and killers in your midst, even when they flog to death and raped to death their little victims and buried them in shallow graves, like the one we excavated, or tried to excavate, at your church's Brantford Indian Residential School. Well, besides my sheer delight in recounting the tale of not-so-crazy Walter, what's causing me to drop you this little note is a lie you tried passing off recently when you said that you have no power to order the release of documents held by your bishop, Bob Bennett, concerning kids who died at the Mohawk Indian Residential School in Brantford. Now, that's an odd thing for you to say, Fred, because, hell boy, you're the fucking primate. The buck stops with you, especially since you speak on behalf of that tottering old woman who my Irish family members like to call that bitch in Buckingham Palace. That means you not only get to wear all sorts of sexy purple outfits, Fred, but you can tell any Anglican priest or a Bishop Bob precisely what to do. Unless I missed something about your ecclesiastical hierarchy. So, your big lie got me wondering, why would the top Anglican in Canada want to conceal documents concerning the Mohawk Indian Residential School? Well, one doesn't need much gray matter to figure that one out, which is frankly what makes you and the whole situation laughable. Because you all know the score, but you pretend not to. You won't even let on the fact that you ordered Leona Moses, a researcher, with your church, to be quiet, on pain of jail or worse, I think were your words. That frankly, the bloodstains from those legions of dead children are all over your Anglican church, Fred, even after all the official scrubbing and whitewashing. So come clean, Mishkin. You know what that you've sealed away documents that prove your church and the British Crown intended and tried to eradicate the Mohawk Nation? You know about the bones we uncovered at the Brantford School that, on forensic analysis, turned out to be that of a human, a little girl about 5 years old? Like I told your co-conspirator, Bishop Bob Bennett, the graves are opening now, and your lies don't work anymore. So, let me remind you of something that you may not know or may have forgotten along the journey to grasp your Archbishop's mitre. Since the truth always comes out, all of the king's horses' asses cannot keep even the biggest lie enthroned forever, Fred. And that's bad news not only for you, but for your boss, Lizzie Britt, and her pack of inbred, moronic, child-killing family members. You know, Fred, history shows us time and again that in the final days of a dying regime like yours, the decisions of the people at the top, so-called, always become more and more self-destructive, irrational, and just plain stupid. That's why the abomination called your church may only be summed up with a simple gesture, and that is to be laughed at. All we can do is laugh and mock you, like Walter and Jesus did so well. So relax, numbnuts. Nothing's in your hands anymore. The great wheel of destiny is turning, and those with eyes to see and hearts to feel will know where they belong now. And that's not in your ranks. But one final point, and let's end on a humorous note. I hear that after getting rid of some of the most incriminating Mohawk school documents, they don't call him the Shredder in Huron Diocese for nothing, your Bishop Bob Bennett tried the usual distraction ploy by announcing, guess what, a new policy in his diocese. And you got to love those quaint old Roman terms, diocese. Anyway, in the Huron Diocese now, according to Bishop Bob Bennett, henceforth, no Anglican clergyman can drive alone in a car with a child anymore. I kid you not. I'd call that an admission of guilt, wouldn't you? Well, you got to hand it to the crazies. They only keep getting crazier. Anyway, Merry Christmas, Mr. Primate. Now go eat a banana. Well, Fred, I hope you get that. And we will be seeing you outside your Anglican conference between July 10th and 16th, where, among other things, people will be trying to enforce the standing arrest warrant against you for concealing crimes against humanity and possibly even being complicit in the death of Leona Moses and others. Well, enough of Fred. Here's the second thing I want to read you from The Border, and it's entitled, So What Do You Believe Anyway, Kev? Well, George Leong was a logger in my Port Alberni congregation. He hated environmentalists, and he kept his kids away from Indians. He also didn't like my sermons. You never tell us what to believe, Kev, he complained to me one Sunday during after-church coffee. Is that my job? I replied Socratically. Well, you're the minister after all, George exclaimed desperately. If you don't know about God, then who does? Well, it's funny because people stopped asking me about God years ago. I guess the consensus was that once I was officially defrocked from the United Church of Canada, that somehow disqualified me from membership in the God Expert fraternity. But recently that's changed, perhaps because of the success I've had in combating religious group crime. The formerly unspoken question is now being asked of me, what do I think of Jesus anyway? Well, listen up. This is taken from a mini sermon I gave once called Table Talk Number 3. What is this thing called the Jubilee? Doing more than preaching. And it's based on Leviticus chapter 25 and Luke chapter 4, verses 14 to 21. I was 4 years old when I first helped myself to the bread out of the baker's truck. My mother, always hawk-eyed when it came to yours truly, spotted my deed and confronted me as I calmly sat munching my prize on the sidewalk outside our home. I was hungry, I explained when Mum asked me why I had taken the bread. I had no idea why something so obvious needed an explanation. Nor did I understand her attempt to explain the strange concept of money to me. Well, my mother perhaps blamed this early formative moment for my tendency to give away anything in our house that wasn't nailed down to those people who needed it more than we did. Cutlery, food, toys, clothing, even Mum's favorite fondue set ended up in the hands of the local needy families. Mum started locking up everything. And just imagine, back then I hadn't even started reading the Bible. My egalitarian streak only intensified when I had scripture revealed to me in United Church Sunday School. There it was in black and white, something that I knew at a gut level. God gave creation to all of us. No mention of rich and poor or debt consolidation loans back in Eden. And even better, not much later in the biblical timeline, the wandering Jews were told by Jehovah that every 50 years they had to pull a Kevin Annett and give away what they had to the needy. Land was to be returned to its original owners. Debts were to be canceled, and all the prison cells opened up and prisoners set free. God called this the Jubilee Year. Well, like all good ideas and divine commands, the Jubilee was never put into practice by we sloppy mortals. Indeed, something else happened. Instead, the recipients of the Jubilee laws, the tribal Hebrews, demanded a king to rule over them and war chariots and other weapons of mass destruction to smash those nasty Canaanites into dust. And for some odd reason, the big shot kings of Israel conveniently forgot about the world turned upside down Jubilee commands given to them by the Almighty One they supposedly were worshiping. Well, that's okay, folks, don't despair. A few centuries later, in a one-camel dump called Nazareth, there appeared a local yokel named Yeshua ben Yosef, who had the temerity to take the law into his own hands. One morning in the synagogue, amid the usual chanting and gossiping and snoring, Yeshua stood up uninvited and announced the following. Okay, everybody, I've got news for you. The Jubilee's arrived. Not in 50 years, not after you've had lunch, but right now, at this very moment, right here. So say farewell to collecting on all those debts. The prison doors just got flung open. No more land grabbing or interest rates or rich and poor. That's all gone now, folks. We're living under a new regime called the Kingdom of Heaven. So rejoice. Well, they didn't rejoice. As a matter of fact, the good friends and neighbors of this rabble-rouser grabbed him and tried to kill him by throwing him off a cliff. But killing him had to wait a few more years to succeed. Meanwhile, Yeshua, the shit-disturber, otherwise known by his Greek name Jesus, walked about the land establishing a new society. And when he went beyond words and tried getting rid of the biggest barrier to God's Jubilee revolution, and that was the money-soaked and militarized temple in Jerusalem, well, you know what happened to him next. And that same fate of crucifixion has befallen all the other poor people in history, like Yeshua, who have ever tried to do as he did, and as God commands, and reclaim the world for themselves and for all other people. When I think back to my young self eating freely and unafraid from the earth's bounty and sharing what I had with others automatically, I'm struck by how inborn and self-evident is the Jubilee spirit within humanity. From each according to their abilities, to each according to his needs. It's that simple. Because the world was made a common garden without barriers, and society would operate exactly that same way, and there wouldn't be suffering and starvation if society reflected the mind of God. But since it doesn't, and instead is ruled and torn apart by the satanic force of greed, of property, of war and class divisions, the Jubilee spirit sweeps in to overturn and return humanity to its source in the natural law. Because once our people moved according to the earth's rhythms and nature's rhythms, we understood innately that society, like nature, has to routinely rest and lie fallow in order to recover and to replenish itself. Inequality and oppression have to withdraw and stand down or be stood down so that natural justice can reassert itself and restore life to everyone. Jubilee wipes the slate clean so that humanity can recover from itself. That's all that Jesus was trying to do. That's all he was trying to demonstrate by his life. But we have fallen away from him and his lesson and from the revolution that he embodied, God's revolution. A crushing wall of might makes right blocks out such liberation. And so a divine blast of change collapses and clears away all of the barriers to God's plan. That's indeed the meaning of Jubilee. It comes from the Hebrew word yobel, which means a trumpet blast, the kind that announces a great event or the arrival of something new. In the book of Leviticus, the people are instructed to hallow the 50th year and proclaim liberty in the land to all of the inhabitants. It shall be a jubilee unto you. Leviticus 25:10. This very saying is inscribed in the American Liberty Bell in Philadelphia and served as the basis of a true republic under God. The fact that heaven ordains and trumpets justice and equality for all people every second generation, every 50 years. Well, Thomas Jefferson went even further than that, and he declared that in order to survive, the American Republic needed a revolution every 20 years. That's, in short, every new generation. In other words, the Republic, like the earth and its people, has to recreate itself with each new generation, recreate itself continually or die. And we've got a lot of evidence to confirm that all around us. The divine plan is for all people to return to a level and equal footing with each other routinely. But of course, every ruling elite in history, whether political, financial, or religious, desires and works for the opposite and hates that equality, considers God's equality impractical and subversive, and calls it all sorts of nasty names. Well, because for many centuries, official Christianity has disregarded the Jubilee Revolution and has sided with the rich rulers of this world, that revolution of equality has been voiced not by God talkers, but historically by the bearers of so-called atheistic creeds like rationalism, socialism, communism. But the truth remains whoever speaks it, and must move from thin words to thick action for it to be real and for it to become life-giving. If Jesus is actually present among us, he can only be known through a visible social arrangement, a new covenant in which free men and women establish the Jubilee equality and renewal in their daily affairs. True faith in Jesus' message must be elevated to a social reality and not be reduced to a dead religious ritual or creed or religion. Jesus demonstrated this literally by setting captives free, returning land to landless peasants, and canceling the debts of any of those people who joined his Jubilee movement. Like any guerrilla leader, he established liberated zones, first in the mines and then in the surroundings of the people, in the land around them. And in that way, he overturned and began to replace the status quo. And that's the only reason he was judicially murdered. Not because he proclaimed himself to be God, the Son of God, because in his time and place in the Roman Empire, crucifixion was reserved solely for political insurrectionists and armed rebels. It wasn't used to kill religious heretics. Stoning was. Today, we find the same struggle play itself out whenever people try to make Jesus' way a living reality in our world. The Jubilee vision is a keg of dynamite being deliberately contained within religion. But I know from having tried to make it real and put it into practice that when we unleash that dynamite and bring poor and rich together and abolish the differences between them and raise up that new society, the full weight of church and state falls upon us and tries to crush us like it did Jesus, as he predicted it would. But the Jubilee Revolution is as necessary now. Its laws are as revolutionary and as much of a threat to the status quo now as they were 2,000 years ago, especially a threat to bankers, to bishops, and to heads of state. And so the vision and the purpose remains, beginning by personally sharing out the wealth of the world, and especially the wealth of the Christian churches, with those who have nothing. For here is the unending challenge. Will we do more than proclaim this word, but actually enact it among ourselves as the equal and freeborn men and women that we are and are meant to be? This is Kevin Anadical, Strong Voice, murderbydecree.com.
And we're back. Kevin, back with you. It's interesting, you know, over the last quarter of a century, actually, I've become identified with a whole movement to expose genocide, child abuse, child trafficking, but there's a whole history before that that people don't know, don't understand, really, because, of course, the necessity of defending children, of confronting this huge crime, tends to outweigh that. But what really characterized me, and still does, is really a spiritual drive. The kind of thing that we just heard about, the thing that Jesus tried to embody, that any of us can embody, once we're standing on our true nature. And it was interesting, when I used to preach like that in Port Alberni, it took the congregation from a handful, 10, 12 people, up to over 80 in 6 months. And these were conservative people. These were loggers. These were people whose folks had settled the Alberni Valley. They had had a vested interest in the status quo. They freaked out when you mentioned residential schools later. But they were amazingly inspired by the message because it broke through all the divisions. It said, we're really one soul. And all these divisions and barriers are bullshit. They don't mean anything. And when we try to embody what Jesus talked about, that's the revolution. That's the Jubilee. That's his real message. And now that message is being hidden and distorted by religion. It's got to be broken free from religion. And that's all we're trying to do. So what I'm saying to you now, when we're talking about the Republic, we have to talk about the change within us that has to precede any of that. And I mentioned this before, about 30, 40 years before the American Revolution, before the first shots were ever fired at Lexington and Concord, there was a thing called the Great Awakening in America. There was this huge movement, grassroots movement. It wasn't started by anybody. It just came, started spontaneously. That was really a movement in the villages and towns to bring Christianity back to the people. You know, it led to the formation of Baptists, Presbyterians, that kind of thing. And they later went on to lead the revolution. There's this funny quote from a British member of parliament who was saying, it's no use. Our American cousin has run away with the Presbyterian pastor, and there's nothing that can be done about it. What he was talking about there, he was talking about the spiritual awakening where people said, we can take our churches back, or we can take the message back away from bishops and kings and popes, among the away from the big money interests. We have to reclaim our tradition. It's interesting, one of the times I went to Scotland, where my family were from, they were driven out of the Highlands, and the Buchanan clan. My mom's name is McCuitt, but they were a sept of the Buchanans. I was standing there on the shores of Loch Lomond, and I got a very clear message. That's where my family had been forced out of. There were none of the villages were left. The tenant farms, they were all wiped out. It was just fields left. But I got a very strong message. This is about 10 years ago now. And it said two things. Kev, do the right thing. Keep doing the right thing and recover Christ. And I didn't understand for a long time what that meant. But I realize now that when I got, my life was practically destroyed. My family taken away, my children robbed from me, blacklisted, attacks that continue still to this day, made a pariah in my own culture. I was tempted to give up my faith. And by that, I'm not talking religiously. I'm talking about the thing that drives me, the thing within us that can never be taken from us, the thing that Christ embodied. And he wasn't any more divine than any of us. He was fully human. And that's what's divine in us. But we're fully human, and we take full responsibility for ourselves and those around us and the world around us. And I realized that that is something I've got to start speaking of more. And one of the reasons we have to do that is not only for the long-term vision, so we don't replicate the old empires in our new republic, but it's really what drives us. And I wrote a book. I collaborated in it. You can also get it online at Amazon. It's called Here We Stand, Summoning God's People in a Time of Judgment, the Call of the New Protestant Reformation. And in that, we articulate a spiritual vision by a network called the Covenanters. And the new covenant that they're trying to establish is to break free of the demonic power in the world and reestablish that God connection in each one of us and have it manifest in spiritual communities. In other words, we're calling the people out of the false churches. This is our alternative. We don't, as Sun Tzu says, you don't tear down the old system, you create a new one. And that's what we have to do spiritually as well as politically. So in the weeks ahead, I want to talk more about that. You can call that a spiritual calling if you like. You can use whatever labels you want. But don't forget, like George Carlin said, the words can mask and hide reality. We can't let it do that. We've got to find our own new words and new language for all of this. Because that jubilee now is occurring as we speak. And the power comes when, as Jesus said in that synagogue in Nazareth, get up and say, I am embodying that kingdom of heaven now, today, not tomorrow, but now. It's in me, and I'm going to make it happen. We embody that revolution. We act on it. That's all we need to do. It seems like a tall order because our words, our minds are still controlled. Breaking free is not something you do in a corner. You don't do it by yourself in a room through the proper meditation techniques. We do it together. We don't get healed, and I don't even like that word. That's another word that hides. Forget about the word healing. We want transformation. We don't want to go back to anything original. We want something totally new, and that comes from within us. Transformation, folks. We do it together. I've seen the power when that happens. We just have to break free from our isolation, our stupid little iPads and internet atomization, deliberately created that way to keep us apart. We have to find each other again in action, and that's how we recover ourselves and build a new society. From thin words to thick action, as Martin Luther King used to say. So we do that now. We've laid out some of that politically and spiritually. We're going to be going into more detail on that in the weeks ahead. Most importantly, get active with us. Write to us, republicofkanata@gmail.com. You can write to me, thecommonland@gmail.com. See murderbydecree.com under ITCCS updates. And go to Amazon. Put in my name, Kevin Ant. You'll see all 16 of my books recently published. Well, Actually, I wrote the 16 over the last 4 years. So it's up to all of us now. Closing song, we're going back to Phil Oakes, and it says a lot. It talks about why we have to act now. It's called When I'm Gone. I thank you, brothers and sisters. We carry this on together. Until next week, stay strong, stay clear.